Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. 90 years ago saw the birth of one of the world's most important independent publishers, Faber and Faber. The company is known for publishing some of the greatest writers of the last century, from T.S. Eliot, also kind of the boss, and Sylvia Plath and Philip Larkin, to Samuel Beckett, to some of the best-selling new names in fiction, such as Sally Rooney and Leila Slimani. Having survived a world war, all of the financial peaks and troughs of the 20th century, and the digital boom in the 21st, how has this literary behemoth kept its doors open and pages turning? Well, Toby Faber, the grandson of the publishing house's founder Jeffrey Faber, has just published a book called Faber and Faber, The Untold Story. This traces the history of the company through letters, reports and diary entries, all by its founders and authors up until 1990, revealing how some of the greatest books of our age ended up on bookshelves around the world, and equally fascinatingly, how some great works were turned down for being rubbish. On the programme today, I'll be joined by Toby Faber, who was Faber's managing director for 4 years and is now a non-executive director and chairman of sister company Faber Music. And later, I'll speak to the novelist and critic Alex Preston, whose books In Love and War, The Revelations and This Bleeding City were all published by Faber. Toby, thank you very much for joining us today. I wanted to start off with the way that you set the book out, and you've done it as a social history rather than as a sort of read-through biography. First of all, why have you done it like that?
Well, corporate histories, they do have this reputation for being amazingly dull books, as you read back saying 1936 was a very good year and things like that. And I just thought, I had this brainwave, basically, that the way to make this book exciting, because I knew there was a really good story to tell.
Yeah.
But the way to make it exciting was not to tell it in my words, but to tell it actually in the words of the people who were living it at the time. So the letters, the diaries, the memos, that really bring out the story, because the people who are, of course, writing them don't know what is going to happen to Faber. So there is that same sense of jeopardy that comes through from reading their words, because they don't know, you know, Lord of the Flies is going to be important or whatever it is. They're just writing in the moment.
And, of course, that way you get to read, I mean, the actual correspondence, editors and novelists and poets' tone of voice. And it's an interesting thing. Some people seem to, even knowing it's just office correspondence, seem to be writing for posterity, or what now looks like it might be. And I'm thinking of Sylvia Plath's letter to her mother, which is one of the things that you look at. And she doesn't seem to have an off day as a writer, even when she's just writing to a family member, whereas other people are just quite officey.
Well, I think you're right, aren't you? And needless to say, when you, when I, writing this book, come across that letter,
yeah,
and I can put it together with the photograph that captures the moment she's talking about of Ted, her husband, on the stairs, being inducted as the new generation of Faber poets, I just think it's terrific.
This is an excerpt of that letter. This is from 1916. It's Sylvia Plath to her mother. Last night, Ted and I went to a party at Faber's given for W.H. Auden. I drank champagne with the appreciation of a housewife on an evening off from the smell of sour milk and diapers.
I know.
And what are you going to do with that?
It just conjures up the image straight away, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect. It's perfect stuff. Philip Larkin, it's amazing. You know, we a lot of listeners might know the correspondence between Philip Larkin and Kingsley Amis, which is famous. Was that published by Faber's?
I don't know. The Larkin letters were,
And, of course, they had a sort of competitive and tender slanging match against the world and kind of against each other. But he's very soft in the early days of his correspondence with Faber. When he's writing to the publishing house and sort of going, I also write poems.
Yes.
Do you mind taking a look?
Well, and sadly, Faber start off by rejecting those poems.
Yeah.
And when he says, do you mind if I show them to another publisher? He says, no, fine, go ahead. Which, you know, you look back on and you think, oh, goodness. And that caused huge amounts of problems that Faber's were not Larkin's original publisher, although we are finally now the publisher of all Larkin's poetry. Yes, he's a diffident young man then. And he even says, when Charles Monteith, who was one of the great Faber editors, first gets in touch with him, he does say, I'm so glad you got in touch, because it stops me thinking of Faber as this rather forbidding father figure.
Yeah. And that's interesting. So, and what about that reputation? The story of Faber, rather the public story of it, and some of the writers that it's published, have given it this slightly sort of stentorian, grandfatherly and grand reputation. Is that fair? What about how did you feel about it when you were the boss?
But it's wonderful as well, isn't
yeah.
it? Because you want people to think Faber stands for something.
Yeah.
And it clearly it stands for excellence and for great writing and all of that. I don't think it also stands for being forbidding. But that's a different question. And you see them struggling with this right from the beginning, actually. So it's amazing how quickly Faber and Faber acquires that reputation. Started yeah. in 1929. During the 1930s, it starts to take on all these great poets. So that by the end of the 1930s, it is absolutely already the gold standard in poetry, with all that that means, and extending to the whole of the rest of modernism, really, literary modernism. So we've already got there by the end of the 1930s, and you see my grandfather worrying about it. You see him saying, I want us to have a reputation for high quality, but that's not the same as being highbrow.
Mm.
We've always got to look to publishing the books that are going to meet a more general readership, even if we are also doing these books that are the ones that now, you know, two generations later, we think of as the books that make Faber's name.
You've taken a lot of these, the guy that didn't sign the Beatles kind of thing, knocks on the chin. Fortunately for Lord of the Flies, well, actually, Down and Out in Paris and London, the George Orwell's first sort of novella, you, Faber rejected?
Faber rejected,
and then
didn't matter, we had the chance to reject him again for Animal Farm in 1944. Yes, you can't.
I feel like we should have an buzzer here.
Yeah, I'm afraid. That's just, it's so sad when you look back on it. But that's what happened, and it was Eliot in both cases, T.S. Eliot. And
yeah.
he had his reasons, which I think were good intellectual reasons, and they weren't to do with thinking the writing wasn't any good, for example. He always recognised the quality of the writing. In the case of Down and Out in Paris and London, he just felt it didn't hang together quite as a book.
Yeah.
In the case of Animal Farm, it was that he didn't feel 1944 was the right time to be publishing a book that is quite so rude about our Soviet allies. And you can understand that in retrospect. You just wish, of course, that he had taken the plunge and done it, because that would have brought us not just Animal Farm, but also 1984, two books that would make any backlist.
We started that part of the conversation, Toby, by talking about the times when Faber didn't sign the Beatles, as it were. William Golding, author of Lord of the Flies, got a reprieve, I think kind of down to Charles Monteith taking the reins, which is a good one. And of course, it was kind of like a kind of Grand National trainer that couldn't stop breeding great horses, right? And it kind of started with William Golding in the late 60s.
We have this wonderful resurgence in the post-war period, led, as you say, from an editorial point of view by William Golding, but more to the point by Charles Monteith. And it's just a terrific story, because here is this book that has gone round numerous other publishers already. It's very dog-eared by the time the manuscript arrives at Faber's. It has this very unpromising cover letter. Dear sirs, I send you the typescript of my novel Strangers from Within, which might be described as an allegorical interpretation of a stock situation.
Yeah.
That is not a selling cover letter.
Yeah. Fortunately, William Golding wasn't writing his own blurbs.
No, exactly. It's already been read by the Faber reader by the time Charles Monteith gets his hands on it, and he says, time, the future, absurd and uninteresting fantasy about the explosion of an atom bomb on the colonies. Rubbish and dull, reject. So it's got nothing going for it.
And by the way, listeners, Toby has no notes. He can remember that
words are imprinted on my brain. Charles Monteith, my understanding of the story always is that he just grabbed it from the slush pile, the pile of unsolicited manuscripts. He had nothing else to read on the train, so he read beyond that rubbish and dull first chapter to get into the book behind, which, as we know, is much more interesting. Interestingly, once he got beyond that first chapter, those pages behind were much less dog-eared as well.
Yeah.
In fact, he was the first publisher ever to get beyond it. And of course, then the correspondence back and forth between him and Golding, stripping out that first chapter entirely, lots of other changes to create the book we know today.
In the 1980s, or the late 70s, I suppose, there was this kind of new generation of British and, what was it, Peter Carey, Australian, Salman Rushdie, and various people coming from various places. But there was kind of real, there felt like there was a kind of sea change. Ian McEwan and Martin Amis and Salman Rushdie, as you mentioned. Peter Carey, who else would,
and Kazuo Shiguro,
of course.
Yep.
And that was a sort of fascinating time, and a time when Faber could kind of stretch its intellectual muscles and its sort of muscles in the marketplace. How's that dealt with in the book, and what was that?
Well, we had two strokes of luck to enable us to ride that wave, which started, as you say, at the beginning of the 80s.
Mm.
The first stroke of luck was recruitment, and it always is, in the end, the story of recruiting a brilliant editor from Eliot, then Charles Monteith, and yep. now talking about the 1980s, it's Robert McCrum.
Yeah.
Who comes in as a very young man with absolutely very little background to really to recommend him, other than that he clearly had the intellect and he got on well with the people at Faber's. And he was lucky, the firm was lucky, because his arrival pretty much coincided with the firm starting to feel quite flush again. And the reason we felt flush was because of the musical Cats.
And this is such a funny, and people will might not know why, but then it will easily fit into place. Yeah. So tell us about how this.
So the musical Cats is based on the poems in Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, written by T.S. Eliot, published by Faber back in the 1930s. That meant that essentially Faber and Faber were the agent to the Eliot estate on exploiting Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. So the Eliot estate received a lyricist percentage of the royalties from Cats. Faber and Faber received an agent's percentage on that lyricist percentage. That percentage of a percentage was enough money, not just for the firm to keep going in the 80s, not just actually to fund Robert McCrum's acquisitions, because some of them, of course, required big advances, but also for the firm to transform itself in terms of its own business by actually doing all its own paperbacks, which is a crucial thing, actually, for a hardback publisher to have longevity. So although a lot of that money from Cats was wasted, enough wasn't wasted to really give the firm the basis for what enables it to carry on flourishing today.
And that period of the success of the sort of big selling literary novel in the 1980s, that must have been like in the music industry in the kind of transition from the 60s to the 70s. It wasn't like Faber hadn't, you know, had a great deal of success before, but this must have been kind of different, and the personalities involved were quite different. What was that like?
So what did you have? Well, you had all sorts of structural things going on. You had things like Waterstones, of course, and the other big chain bookstores starting up. So you had an explosion in the retail trade. You had things like the Booker Prize suddenly becoming a really big deal.
So writers became famous outside.
So writers became stars. Yeah. People were buying the Booker winner or whatever it was. And then you had all these publishers around chasing the writers who they thought were going to be next Booker winner, piling their books high in the retail space. A lot of that was not necessarily feeding through into final sales and final reading, so a lot of that money was being wasted. Nevertheless, it was clearly a good time for writers in particular. Literary writers were making money in the 1980s in a way that they certainly didn't before, and which arguably few of them have since, I'm afraid. The landscape is not quite as benign now as it was then for writers. But it was clearly, all part of Thatcher's Britain in a funny sort of way, or I think a lot of the people working at Faber's would hate to be told that, but it was all the sort of boom time of money chasing more money and people having fun doing it, really.
And what were the lunches like in those days? Because some of them are written about, some of the expenses claims are written about and are part of your social history. Because this is the stuff that people love to know what T.S. Eliot was writing and what his kind of like in-house memo style was like, obviously. Yes. But people obviously, as you know, that's why it's in the book.
A bit of the gossip. So, I mean, well, Robert McCrum is very proud, as far as I can tell.
I'm on his side, I think.
Of the time he, and as he puts it rather coyly, another editor went out to lunch, a very long, very boozy lunch, and returned and justified the expense as lunch with T.S. Eliot, which, given that T.S. Eliot had died back in 1965, might have been challenged, but apparently wasn't. So,
not on your watch, Toby.
Not on my
exactly.
watch, before I arrived.
And just finally, does Faber still keep all its correspondence? I mean, these will be emails.
They are emails,
sadly, now. But there's a different way, maybe, that people write these things.
Well, so the answer is yes, we do keep them. As I should think you could say every company now keeps its emails.
Accidentally.
We try to have protocols about how they are filed and things like that. I am sure these protocols are honoured more in the breach than in the observance. Mm. If somebody wants to write the similar sort of book to one I've just written in, say, 50 years' time, I think they'll probably be able to do it, but they will have so much more material to have to wade through all these emails. So they'll have to have some pretty good search algorithms to take them through the emails and things like that. I can imagine it will work. It could work, yeah.
Okay. Toby Faber, thank you so much indeed for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now the novelist Alex Preston joins me to talk about what Faber's like for a writer.
We're here to talk about this wonderful, wonderful history of the company. Throughout the company's history, you get this idea that actually being published by Weber's means something, and it means something to such an extent that, you know, they're able to pay their authors rather less in terms of advances. They're able to maybe not offer what some other publishers offer because you've got those double Fs on the spine of your book. There is something magical about those double Fs. Walter Donohue, my editor, always described it as something lovely to have on one's cufflinks. And I think that's, you know...
It's the equivalent of being signed to an avant-garde, ultra-respected record label when those things existed. It's amazing that we're celebrating 90 years of Faber and all those, you know, that those rough trades and everyone else has kind of come and gone in other industries. What does it amongst novelists, everyone is particular, everyone has their own experience and their own idea of what a reputation is. But what was Faber's for you? Why did you want to be published by them?
I think several reasons. The first of them being that my grandfather had been published by them. He's an American academic, but his great book, The Auden Generation, his name is Samuel Hinds, was published by them in the year of my birth, 1979. And so there was just something about
that's
when
got a nice ring
it has it. It has a nice ring to it. I also, when I'd written my novel and I understood that it was going to be published by someone, I went and saw a friend who had also been published by Faber, and they had done his book very well. Simon Reeve, who's now mainly known for his telly, although actually wrote a wonderful
great travel writer.
And anyway, they had done his earliest book, which had done phenomenally well. And he said, you know, they are really, when they get behind a book, they get behind it properly. And that was absolutely my experience of them, that I went in and saw other publishers, and it just wasn't quite the same. And it's been very strange for me. My latest book, I've done a nonfiction nature memoir, which, because of the format of it and because, frankly, of the expense of putting it together, it's a very kind, it's illustrated. And we didn't go with Faber in the end. We went with Little Brown instead. And it's felt, you know, it's been a lovely experience publishing it, but it has felt strange. And going back to Faber now for my next novel does feel a lot like coming home. And I couldn't really imagine certainly one of my novels being published by somebody else.
And when you say Faber's had a reputation amongst novelists of your age at that point when you were publishing This Bleeding City, what, when you say do a novel well, what's that mean? I mean, obviously there's your relationship with the editor, and I'd like to talk about your relationship with Walter Donohue in a bit. We'll come to that. But what's doing a book well?
I mean, I think, you know, this is the great ineffable thing about publishing is that, and again, something you get so strongly from reading through this history of the company is that still nobody really has an idea what makes the difference in
some
terms of a book.
Yeah.
It is to do with the cover. It is to do with the publicity. It's to do with how the publisher chooses to position it. It's to do with their relationship with the bookshops. It's to do with all these things. In the end, it's slightly a shot in the dark. And I was, I was lucky with This Bleeding City that it was of the moment and that I had a brilliant person looking after the publicity at the time, Rebecca Pearson, was just amazing. And just Faber's always felt like they had an ownership of the book and that they cared about it and that it was something that everyone was behind. And that was a wonderful feeling. And it was sort of my second book didn't do anywhere near as well, sort of slightly sunk without trace. And they were also lovely during that. And I think that, I think that really means something. And then on the third book, there was no loss of enthusiasm. And when that did really well, it was, I guess at every step, I felt like it was sort of being part of a big family.
I asked Toby Faber this about writers who can't help being writers, even when they're writing an email or a letter in those days to their editor. This was we talked about Sylvia Plath's letter to her mother, which described a party in poetic way. What's been the tone of your emails between you and Walter when you're trying to be buoyant, I suppose, and honest, but you're doing a job of work to edit a novel? a transcript. What is that like?
It's interesting. So Walter is an enigmatic figure. He's an extraordinary man and has been at Faber for a long time and is an old-fashioned editor. So the edits are done by hand on a manuscript and they're done line by line, and he uses all of the old symbols and signals that I have to look up on the internet.
Old subbing language.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah. So actually a lot of it occurs in person in the London Review bookshop just over the road from Faber, where there's an excellent little coffee shop that we go and sit in and work through the manuscript together. But I think in terms of our emails, it is hard not to think as you're writing them that this is part of the work. And I certainly, you know, I read over the emails I write to him more carefully than perhaps the emails I write to maybe my editor on the newspaper or whatever. And that's partly because, you know, it is a relationship that is based on being careful and having respect for the shape of a sentence. And he's a beautiful writer as well, although very kind of lapidary and not at all effusive. And so it's very often hard to tell whether he likes. And indeed, I sent him the latest draft of my current novel that I'm working on, and I was nervous about it because it's been a little while. I've done a book somewhere else, and I had to send back to him, yes, but do you like it?
Yeah.
and then he was lovely about it, but it requires a little bit of nudging occasionally.
There's a bit of cat and mouse, well, obviously, but on both sides, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I except that it is brilliantly uncommercial. And actually, one of the things I loved about reading this book about Faber's is what a businessman and an entrepreneur Jeffrey Faber was, and how on the kind of skin of his teeth and seat of his pants, if you can mix those metaphors, he was certainly at the beginning, and just brilliantly kind of inventive and brave and daring and the kind of financial nous there. With Walter, it's quite the opposite. He understands that one has to eventually make a living from the books, but he's much more interested in the book being as brilliant as it can be.
Reading this book, The Untold Story of Faber and Faber, and having had Toby in this studio earlier on, I thought it was a very good read. I mean, a social history is a great way of doing a book like this. It's so much better than the dense prose and the occasional quote popping up and having to do background checks on who everyone is. It's a lovely way of doing it. What kind of jumped out for you? Were there poets, novelists, editors, eras that you didn't, this shone a light on for you? What are some of the sort of best bits of The Untold Story?
I mean, I think, of course, Eliot is one of those. I mean, he's a central figure throughout. He's a central figure in the history of the company and indeed of British literature. And the picture one gets of him, I have a sort of slightly love-hate relationship with his poetry, in that I always love it more in recollection than I do when I'm actually reading it. And I find it quite sort of prissy quite a lot of the time. He comes across as an incredibly warm and often lovely man, although what was interesting to me was that Jeffrey Faber, when it was still Faber and Guire, when it was right at its beginnings, he said we should take on Eliot. He's a banker and has got a firm business sense. And I'd always understood Eliot's time at the bank to be when he worked at Lloyd's as being this kind of miserable thing that he had to escape from. You know, he is a businessman, and every letter he writes in which he's taking someone on, he's always talking about money. There's a, you know, so the first bestseller that he actually acquired was a book about the Bible called Who Moved the Stone? And he wrote in his
good title.
He said, I began reading, this is his report to the board of directors, to the publishing committee that purchases the book. I began reading this book with every prejudice against it, but was very quickly interested. I should like to publish this book. I suggest, of course, no advance and modest royalties.
Yeah.
And again, in this letter to Marianne Moore, you know, one of the great poets, and thinking what a thrilling moment to take on a poet like this, he says, there is not, of course, very much money in poetry for anybody. And so he was, you know, and indeed, you know, when he purchases shares in Thebes for the first time, he does it with the proviso that he has a kind of drawdown facility on royalties against an advance on his future publications. Again, he was incredibly shrewd,
savvy,
very savvy, but also so warm. And you know, there's that famous letter in which he takes on Ted Hughes, which is so lovely. I can't remember the exact. I'm inclined to think we ought to take this man now.
Yeah.
And also, you know,
It is a bit like picking a first 11.
It is. Yeah. It is a bit like that. It's also, you know, the ones they miss out on. Obviously, yeah. Orwell and the, you know. It seems counter to the identity of Fabers that actually they missed out on Ulysses, they missed out on Animal Farm because they were concerned about their reputation.
Yeah.
They were where you know, and particularly I think the Orwell decision, where it was taken because they didn't want to offend the Russians. It was 1944, yeah. and it just seems, I think the company now is sort of braver.
And there's a wonderful letter from T.S. Eliot, and I don't know if it's to Charles Monteith or to Geoffrey Faber, saying, also, I feel bad. You should pay me less.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
So there he is, savvy. He's also savvy for the accounts of the business as a whole, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
Having, obviously, interests in it. How likely is that to happen in the 21st century publishing industry, Alex Preston?
yeah, it is not an industry in which, I think, you know, just as Eliot said to Marianne Moore, poetry doesn't pay anyone. I think, you know, largely literary fiction doesn't, although, you know, Faber keeps getting bailed out by these. And I remember when it was when things were really bad, it was they had the P.D. James Death Comes to Pemberley that did so well, that was sort of like a line thrown from shore. And, you know, and now Sally Rooney has come along. But my sense is now that it's a much more broad based success, that it's, you know, yes, having Sally Rooney there selling hundreds of thousands of copies is wonderful, but that there is now a list building where they are having successes throughout fiction and nonfiction. They've got a very good crime list now. They've got kids' books that are doing very well. That I think that they are becoming a kind of major publishing house again.
And better to be bailed out by your novelists and poets than by the creditors. What a wonderful change that makes in media generally. Alex Preston, thank you very much indeed.
Lovely to see you.
That brings us to the end of today's show, and Toby Faber's Fabertastic, Faber and Faber, The Untold Story is out now, published by Guess Who. And Alex Preston's This Bleeding City, The Revelations and In Love and War are all available, also published by Faber. Thanks to my guests, Toby Faber and Alex Preston, of course, and to my producer, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.